Welcome to another edition of the NHL Executive Suite. We are so pleased to have with us the general manager of the New York Islanders, which almost sounds a little strange to say. But I have to say, when we first had the idea this summer to do this podcast, you were one of the first people that I wanted to have on. And I feel like we have so much to talk about, and there's so many things I want to ask you about. But I would say that you left the Devils in the spring of 2015. If I had told you even 3 or 4 years ago that between then and now, you would have gone to Toronto, been the general manager there for 3 years, revamped the roster, they're closer to contending for a Stanley Cup than they've been in a couple decades, and you've become a general manager of the Islanders, who you used to compete against for almost 30 years, what would you have said?
Same thing you're thinking. I would not have believed it.
So how did that happen?
It's interesting. When I left the Devils, that was certainly something that was not looked upon that I would probably do at any given time. Brendan Shanahan came to me and asked me, what do you think? And I said to him, and that's after he had asked permission from ownership to speak to me, and I said, intriguing. That was the word, and before I knew it, I was the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs and spent 3 great years there. And the way the contract was written, I was going to spend another 5 years there in sort of a consultant role, you know, and enjoying life maybe. And then, unbeknown to me, Scott Malkin had spoken to Larry Tannenbaum, the owner of the Maple Leafs, and potentially having a conversation with me, and that evidently transpired during the playoffs in Toronto. And when Larry spoke to me and Brendan spoke to me after the playoffs, I really did not think of any interest at that given time. We had just lost in the playoffs in Toronto. And then the question came up again, so out of due respect to Scott Malkin, you know, I did have a conversation, and here I am sitting here talking to you as a New York Islander.
How does that sound? How does it feel? How is it?
Well, I think, first of all, the people have been just outstanding to work with. Ownership has been tremendous. I really got to know and appreciate the success and why that Scott Malkin is doing what he's doing. And the vision that he has, and the dream of putting a new facility here, which is so well needed. And as you well know, you know, more than me, the history of this franchise and the staple that it has, it would be nothing better than a challenge to help resurrect it to where it was in the past. And that's what we're trying to do.
You can't say no to a challenge.
Obviously.
So Toronto sort of takes us back, if we go back to the beginning, because of the history with Johnny Bower. Let's go back to Providence, and you played baseball as well as hockey. Which came first, and tell us about growing up in Providence.
Well, first of all, that's like the chicken and the egg when it came to the two sports, you know, baseball and hockey. My parents, my dad, my mom, for whatever reason, wanted us to be into sports at an early age, and I started off, first of all, with Little League at a very young age. Somehow my family was very much into hockey. At that day and age, you had only the American Hockey League. You had the 6 original teams, and the Providence Reds were one of the premier franchises. And I was carried into games, you know, the Rhode Island Reds, watching them play. And somehow my family had a relationship with some of the players, maybe because my mother cooked so well and they were there for, you know, the Italian dinners. And, you know, just that I became entrenched in the game of hockey, but also baseball was, during the season, was just as involved as I was, and played both sports through high school, both sports through college and so forth.
So your mom was a good cook. Did she do the cooking, or your dad had a restaurant? Is that right?
My father was in the fish business and did have a restaurant with that. He was in the whole family was in wholesale and retail fish. They actually had boats in Narragansett, where the old days they went out with the fishing nets. So I grew up on fish, and I'm still eating it. the restaurant really was what attracted, I'm sure, a couple of the players at that given time. And you know, relationships come about, and, you know, before you know it, you know, you're involved.
So who were the players that you admired, and what was that like for you to be a kid and have some of those? I'm sure they were sort of celebrities at the time come in, and you got to hang around with them.
Well, what happened was I ended up being a stick boy. I just about could reach the doorknob of the locker room and, you know, going into it. And, you know, you had sort of a little bit of freedom or a luxury that, you know, other kids didn't have. And some of the players in those days, you know, of course, Johnny Bauer was just, you know, a special human being. And his wife, Nancy, had stayed with my parents for a period of time when he came to Providence to play. The first phone call I got when I went to Toronto was actually from Johnny Bauer. So these type of relationships, and that's all public knowledge. He put that in his book, or I really wouldn't speak of it. And other people, you know, I could just go on and on who had an effect on my life just watching what they did. You know, I was that little child that we see at the rinks today where my first, you know, pair of hockey gloves were wrapped in a newspaper so the player snuck it out the door so I could have it after the game, or getting a stick around the corner. So I experienced all of that, so I can certainly appreciate, you know, what we all try and do these days to encourage people to be involved in sports. I know how much of an impact it had on me.
Do you see yourself sometimes then in the kids who are around the rink or want to watch or have their face pressed up against the glass?
I would have to say so in some way, and I was fortunate enough to be on the inside, you know, looking out more than the outside looking in, and, you know, also had impressionable people, you know, who taught me the good side, and also I think I learned from what I didn't like. But it was a tremendous experience. I actually traveled with the team, not all the time, but they allowed me to go, and some of the great names. I remember being on a top bunk of Camille Henry before he went up to the Rangers, you know, in Providence. And then when I went through high school, certainly we practiced at the same arena because there was only one arena at that time. And then the association remained. And then actually I went through college and still stayed involved.
So your family was almost like a billet family for Johnny Bauer. Was it his girlfriend at the time or his wife?
It was his wife. It wasn't a billet. It was just a relationship and friendship. I don't think they knew how long Johnny was going to be there, you know. So they became friends and certainly remained that for a good period of time.
And he just passed away.
Yes, he did. It was a very tough time, and you know, I relate Johnny to Yogi Berra, who I had the good fortune to spend a lot of time with because of John McMullen and their relationship. They were the same. They were so humble. They were icons, and in fact, they had the, in my opinion, something in common that very few people can have. I don't know of anyone who has said a bad word about Yogi Berra or Johnny Bauer.
What else did they have in common? What else did you see in them?
Well, I saw a dedication to their profession. I mean, you're talking about two of the best to ever play the game, both having that commitment to excellence and, you know, paying the price to do so. I can remember a story about Johnny Bauer when they were at the house and he was actually staying there, and he had a game the next day, and he excused himself from the table about 8:30 because he had a game the next day and walked up the stairs. That impression stays on me today. And, you know, watching Yogi, even when he retired, when he used to come to the practice facility, and the way he worked out and the way he ate and the way he took care of himself, there was a reason. I used to tell him, with that body, which you'd never think could do the things he did in the game, had so much success.
So Yogi Berra was a catcher. You were a catcher, is that right, when you played? Did you start as a catcher?
Started as a catcher, you know, and then played third base and played some outfield. So, you know, when you've played baseball, and depending upon what teams you're on and how they feel you can best serve, I liked catching, obviously, because you were in control of what was going on.
No, not you.
But, you know, I love the game of baseball. Still do. Look back on some great years.
You got to a pretty high level, though. I mean, you got to the Cape Cod League. Is that right?
I played in high school and then went to college and played. And then after my freshman year, we went down and played in the Cape League, which to me, is one of the best leagues. At that time, there were only three college leagues. There was the Canadian League, the Basin League, and the Cape Cod League, and played with some great players and enjoyed it. Then went back, actually, and managed and coached in the Cape League after that. So it was a great experience.
Did you think that could have been your path?
Well, I had an opportunity to go during my senior year and sign. That was probably one of the toughest decisions that I ever had to go through, because I really don't know today why I didn't do that. There were a lot of factors involved. That was back in the end of 63, 64, and the Olympics of 64 were up, and Eddie Jeremiah had asked me to go to the Olympic tryouts for hockey. And if I had signed an NHL contract, a Major League Baseball contract, at that time it was with the Giants, I would have been ineligible for, say, the Olympics. I went through a similar experience when I was in college, because after my senior year, the Providence Reds wanted to send me to New Haven to play in the Eastern League, and I couldn't do that because I would have been ineligible for baseball for that. So it was a whirlwind of why and why not, and I still saved the contract today as a little, what would have been or what could have been. But I have no regrets on any decisions that I've made. You go forward. But that was a trying year as far as decisions go.
How much was the contract for? Was it a dollar value?
It was a cup of coffee and a hamburger to go and play in the, in A-ball. They wanted to send me to Springfield for the rest of the year, AAA, but just to be there. And then they were going to send me, to the Carolina League the next year, of course, where everyone started and should start. I think in this day and age, no matter what professional athletes we have, when they sign, they want to get to the next level yesterday and don't want to pay the price. But I understood that and certainly understand it more today than I ever do. But it was an intriguing time. It was a difficult time. I can remember it vividly. My parents left everything to me, what I wanted to do. So here we are today.
So you did choose Providence College and the hockey route. So many are thankful that you did. So you were coaching in Providence, a lot of success. When you go back and look at that time, your team goes to the Frozen Four, you hire Rick Pitino, they go to the Final Four. What was that time at Providence like?
Well, first of all, Providence wasn't, right in my mind initially. When I got out of high school, I was very young. I graduated high school at the age of 16, and Brown University wanted me to go to prep school. I decided to do that. I went to Bridgeton Academy, and my roommate was a young man named Brad Cliff, who was also there as a sort of postgraduate. He was a baseball player, and he was a catcher. But, he was a real prime prospect at that time. And all I heard from him is, what am I doing in school? I think I'm going to sign. And academically, I had done, fairly well, and I was really just taking courses because they thought I was maybe young to go to college. And Jim Fullerton, the Brown University, that coach at that time, had encouraged me to go a year. So Brad left after 2 days.
2 days?
After the fourth day, I called the coach of Providence College, Tom Eccleston, and said, the hockey coach, do you still have an opening for that scholarship for me to come to Providence? So after 4 days of prep school, I was at Providence College, and that's how it all started. I went in at 20 and, at 16 and got out at 20. So that was my history and how Providence College, and played two sports there, and it is what it is today.
So were you a math teacher and then you went back to coaching? How did that happen?
Well, what happened was that I played a year after I graduated. I played in the Canadian Provincial League of Baseball in Thetford Mines in Quebec. And then what happened was the Providence College asked me to go back if I wanted to coach. And I was still thinking, should I try baseball a little more? So they asked me to go back and be the freshman coach for hockey and baseball. I couldn't have lived on that, so I ended up teaching at a local high school that had double sessions. So they started school at 7, and I was out by 12, so it didn't interfere with practice of both sports. So I did that at Providence for 4 years, but while I was doing that, I also did go back to the Cape League, and I managed in the Cape League and had some great players. So I had Bobby Valentine, and who we still remain great friends. And that was the year when Bobby Valentine was there, and Thurman Munson was down there, and actually they went 4 and 5 in the draft. Thurman went to the Yankees, and Bobby went to the Mets.
What were they like then?
Well, they were great ball players. I mean, Bobby was one of the youngest in the league at that time. He was coming out of Stanford High School. He was the youngest player, and Thurman came from Kent State, so he was playing like I did, you know, in between his college years. But you had a lot of great ball players. You go to the history of the Cape League, and it's just amazing how many have gone through that league and had success in Major League Baseball. So getting back, I taught for 4 years while I was doing both. In those days in college, freshmen couldn't play, so I had my own team. And the head coach of the hockey team at that time was Elio Toppizzini, who actually was with the Providence Reds as a player when I was growing up. His brother Jerry played for the Bruins. When Elio decided to retire, that's when I took over the head coaching job at Providence and tried baseball, doing it for another year, but it was too much. And then we built the rink, and I coached there for, I don't know, some 13, 14 years, and then was asked to be athletic director. So I did both for a year, and that's when we brought Rick in. History as it is.
What made you think Rick Pitino was going to be a good coach? He's a young coach. What did you see in him? Why'd you want to hire him?
Well, I was thrown into the basketball world, and at that given time, Providence basketball was, you know, extremely big. I mean, the players like Lenny Wilkins and Johnny Egan at that time, and Joe Mullaney was the original coach there, who actually coached for the Lakers. That was the prime sport. Hockey was second. And there was a lot of question, you know, what's a hockey guy going to do with a basketball program? So, you know, I knew a little bit about the Big East. The first person I tried to go after was John Thompson, because John was a year behind me at Providence, and he was coaching Georgetown. And we spoke. We were actually lockers next to each other. You know, here he is, 6'10", 11", and I'm 5'9". And we remain friends to this day. And so, you know, you just try and look and see who is the best out there. And I had heard of Rick only because of being in the Big East when it started. And Rick was an assistant coach at Hawaii and assistant coach at Syracuse at that time. And for different reasons, he didn't get a head coach, but went to Boston University. And of course, with my involvement with hockey, the athletic director was very high on him, John Simpson. And then I got a call from Hubie Brown, who was the coach of the Knicks at that time. And Rick was the assistant coach at the Knicks. And he says, I really think you ought to, you know, talk to him. And I was very impressed with him. There's no question in the conversation he could recruit. And in my opinion, you know, from what I heard about as a coach, and I was concerned that why he would want to come to Providence, because where we were at that given time, he came and you know, he put an all-star staff together when you really think of the coaches there. And we had Jeff Van Gundy as an assistant coach, Stu Jackson. So you knew, you know, there was a great chance of success. And Herb Sindek, and that was the year of the first three-pointer in college. And Billy Donovan was a senior at that time. So that was a, you know, a great year for Providence College, you know, the Final Four and hockey, the Final Four and basketball, and a lot of success in other sports. We had, I think at that year too, we had the winner of the marathon here in New York as far as track. So it was a big year, and one thing led to another. And during the same year, John McMullen got me to consider going to the Devils. And Rick, a month after I left, he got the call from the Knicks. So he went to the Knicks. So we both left the same year. And history is something that you never even think about until you're involved in a discussion like this.
So you go to the Devils, and what was maybe the most important thing you did when you first got there?
Well, I think that the most important thing was establishing a relationship with John McMullen. It was tested in my first year. If you recall, I think everybody recalls around Easter time an incident where the year or two before the Devils were called Mickey Mouse. And then we had a situation with a coach and a referee, and we challenged the league. And I said to Dr. McMullen, you know, you'd call Mickey Mouse. This is an opportunity to put a stamp, and wrongdoing is happening right here. Our coach did not do what he's being accused of. So let's get an injunction, maybe steer the pot a little, and show that the Devils are for real. So I think that was where Dr. McMullen and I became, one.
In your time with the Devils, you then became part of the business side when it became Yankees, Nets, Devils, and it really sort of took you back to your experiences with baseball and basketball. I mean, even being around then, I didn't really know when you were in charge of all those things that you had that much experience with it. What was your relationship like with George Steinbrenner? How did that all influence what you did over the years with the Devils?
Well, first of all, when I was with Dr. McMullen, his dream was to build a new facility, and that facility was going to be built in Hoboken. It was pretty much along the way. The building, a lot of people don't know, was going to go into a partnership with Madison Square Garden, Jim Dolan, I should say Chuck Dolan, Jim's dad, and John McMullen were very close as far as friends and business people. And Madison Square Garden was going to build a facility where John McMullen was going to run it. It was going to be built over the train center, similar to what had just happened in Boston, the old Boston Garden. And there was a commitment from the governor to do that. And then what happened, prior to that, Yankee Nets was formed, where the Yankees and the Nets went together, and they had, you know, that was their dream to form the YES Network. And Ray Chambers, who was part of that, wanted to build an arena in Newark. The governor, you know, backpedaled with John McMullen where the commitment was to build it, and he said, I'm going to sell the team. So when that was the word that he couldn't build in Hoboken, Yankee Nets, at that given time, George Steinbrenner and Ray Chambers and another gentleman who's passed, Lewis Katz, went to Dr. McMullen, and Dr. McMullen came to me. And so I was the person who sold the team to Yankee Nets. And at that given time, Dr. McMullen said that I was basically not on the contract, so I could do anything I wanted. And George Steinbrenner personally came to me, who I had never really known other than certainly the success that the Yankees had. I was a Yankee fan, so I knew a lot about them and certainly followed them. And I was very impressed with him with the first meeting and what he thought, because I actually told him that he should not, you know, want me to come back. He should go out and hire someone else, because they had a great staff. Everything was good, but if the people who were working there couldn't hear the voice that they heard before and doing things the way I was allowed to do them with John McMullen, it wasn't fair to them, and they would be confused. So if he wanted to change things or wanted to operate a little different, he should get somebody new to come in. They would adjust to that better than me adjusting to a change, which I probably couldn't do. And I think he liked that. So we got together, and he felt very strongly on me going there. And your original question with the relationship that I had with him was impeccable. And to this day, the relationship with the Steinbrenner family, I can't say enough about. During those years there, we spent a lot of time together. And, you know, I hear a lot of stories about George Steinbrenner, but I'll tell you what, philanthropically, he liked to do things quietly without people knowing. And every time I went to Tampa Bay, he would pick me up either for breakfast or lunch, and we'd go. And I'm going to tell a story that a lot of people would never have heard unless they hear it from me. He always wore the devil ring when he came to get me. I never said, "You've got the devil ring on." He never said, "Do you see the devil ring on me?" It was just like it was there. But he was special. He and John McMullen were two unique individuals. You never had to worry about what they were thinking. You never had to leave a meeting saying, I wonder if there was something else on their mind, because you got it straight. And if you didn't have thick skin, it was going to be different. But there was a trust. There was a belief. You know, that's how I got involved with the Nets. He called me up one day and said, I'd like to have lunch. And I had lunch with him and Ray Chambers and Lewis Katz. And they said, we'd like you to take the Nets over while you've got the Devils. And I says, I really don't, think that that's the right thing, nor do I feel good about it. I says, because you have somebody named Rob Thorne, who I have a tremendous respect and relationship. And then they said, we'd like you to take over the organization. Rod be general manager. So I said, well, I'd like to talk to Rod first. And I went to Rod and I said, listen, they'd like me to do this. And he said, I love it. He says, I have to deal with you. He says, and you can deal with the owners. But to this day, Rod and I are great friends. And we had great success and great times together. And when you really look back at what these gentlemen did and what Mr. Steinbrenner did in forming Yankee Nets and where the YES Network is today, and in one given year, we win the Stanley Cup, win the World Series, and the Nets go to the finals. And YES becomes an empire. What more and what better experience could you have and work with better and stronger people?
So you said you would leave a meeting with them and you knew where you stood. Now, people would say the same thing about you. That by design?
I don't know if anything is by design. I think your personality is who you are. I think that maybe that's why John McMullen and myself and maybe George Steinbrenner did get along so well, because I think that, we're used to doing things a certain way, not saying it's the right way or the wrong way. Everybody does things in their own way and has success. But there was a certain relationship that was separated. I think that whenever we were talking about a person or a family or whatever, that was separate from the business. It never got in the way. And the business never got in the way of the family. And that's what I admire the most about the both of them. You know, when it came to winning, they knew how to win. And they knew how to do things right. Maybe sometimes upset different people at different times. But there's a lot of people who are not strong enough to do that.
Okay, hard-hitting question. Did you really turn down a role on The Sopranos when they offered it to you?
That's an interesting one. We had a gentleman that I worked for a number of years, a great friend of mine named Chris Madrinsky, who prior to working for the Devils had worked for one of the national television. And I don't know what discussion we were at lunch one day, and The Sopranos came up as a topic. I have no idea what the reasons were. And I said to Chris, you know what, it'd be fun to, sit as an extra and just see what really goes on. So I really didn't follow them, but, at that time they were really at the forefront, and certainly being in New Jersey, and they had all their settings in different places. And so little did I know he was going to go and try and do something. So he said to me, maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, he says, such and such a date, I think, looks like we're not playing, it's open, whatever. He says, you're going to go and, be an extra. People won't even know you're there, but you'll go through the experience you want to go through. And so I, with a smile on my face, said, that should be fun. So we get about 2 days closer to it. He says to me, here's where you're going to go. And so he said, you're going to go to Bada Bing, Bada Bang. So I said, what? What is that? So I found out. So obviously, I did not go. And that was my extra that never happened. That would have been the last thing in the world after I knew where this setting was. So that's the story behind The Sopranos.
That's funny. They couldn't put you like in a red check tablecloth?
Well, I think that was a test, to tell you the truth. No, I don't know. And then after that, there was a couple of other going a yard thing. But I said, no, my little suggestion is forget it.
That's great. Let's talk a little bit about the players of today and your role today. Do you still travel all the time to all the games? What's a typical day like for you?
Well, I think that everybody's day is different. I'm an early riser.
How early?
5:30. you try and get to bed reasonable times, but I think it's important to get rest. I still try and travel as much as I can. I believe in hands-on. I don't know any other way of doing it. I believe in having the best and the strongest people around you. I think that you want to get people who are better than you in a lot of different areas and work with them and challenge yourself each and every day and try and be a challenge to them. But that's, I don't know any other way of putting it.
So you talk about being hands-on. You have been your whole career. There wasn't a part of the Devils, for example, that you didn't have your hand in, whether it was on the ice or off the ice, ticket sales, marketing. Was it that way for you from the beginning? Why did you want to run things that way? Were there things that you wanted to be ever hands-off about?
Well, first of all, you go back. When I went to the Devils, I went in as president. And I was asked by Dr. McMullen, because of my background at Providence College with the hockey program and athletic director, that I did have to run the business of 22 sports, and I was involved with the television contracts and so forth, so business was part of my background as well as sports. But I went in as president and took over business and hockey. So I went in that, and then what happened when I went in April, and then within a short period of time, I named myself general manager, so I had the dual role. And, you know, at that time, You knew where the Devils were. There was a lot of work that had to be done, but had some great young players who worked hard and I think had to learn how to win. And I think that, they were very receptive to everything that was asked of it. And I felt it was, you know, the way I do things to get involved as much as I could. But they ran hand in hand because whatever the business would generate, that was what I had to use to get salaries because I was given the responsibility to run the organization, had to deal with the banks, had to deal with everything A to Z. And Dr. McMullen, you know, really trusted me in that. And, you know, when someone puts you in that responsibility, you have to, you know, get yourself in each and every day-to-day operations. And you have to take ownership in what you do. And I think that a lot of people maybe do not want to do that. Well, that's fine, and they allow other people. I believe in delegation 100%, but I don't believe in it until I'm totally comfortable in the person that you're delegating to that will allow whatever their responsibilities are to go in the right direction, because that's your responsibility. They're a portrait of you, and you're a portrait of them. You want them to have as much success because their success is the success of the organization. But you have to work hand in hand. Unlike myself, Dr. McMullen certainly, you know, had to gain a trust in me, and he had to make sure that I was capable of doing the things because that's how destruction comes. So I think that personality will never change.
Well, I know for sure from personal experience, as a reporter on the TV broadcast of the team, if there was a question I asked one of your players that you didn't agree with, you would let me know. And it's a little bit like the meeting, that you know where you stand when you leave the meeting. And I always knew where I stood with you. And we would have a fair and honest discussion about it. But it's interesting that I don't think you're the only general manager that does that. I think almost every general manager in the league in any sport has an interest in what the broadcast looks like and sounds like, but it seems like you, I don't know, were you the first to do it, or you're someone people use it as an example of someone who does that, but I don't think you're the only one who does that.
No, I absolutely not. I think that, you have to. I think to have success in anything you do, you have to take ownership in what it is that you have a responsibility for. And that ownership doesn't mean that you tell everybody what to do. It's just that you see how it's going, because they're all different parts of success. And they're all different parts that have to interact. And you just have to make sure that everybody, you know, is going in that same direction. And that's where I've always come up with the expression, even with the team, you know, it's like an orchestra. Everybody has an instrument to play. You know, what do you ask out of an orchestra? You ask music. But if each and every one of those instruments, those people do not understand when it's time to stop and the next person picks up where they have to go, it's going to be terrible music. So you have to understand what your role is, and you're willing to give a little for the success with just the big picture. And in players, too, that, you know, the name in the back is there for a reason, and the logo's in front for a reason. And I think that that's also in your office. That's also in everything that you do, because that's just the nature of success.
Well, it's interesting. I always kind of looked at it like in your management style, the way I saw it, was that you see it, the big picture and the orchestra, is that they all matter. In other words, what I am reporting on TV or what your ticket office is doing, that it all matters in terms of success. Is that how you see it? Or
absolutely. Whether you are doing an interview and you were trying to steer the pot, so to speak.
I didn't stir the pot, did I?
Maybe.
Once in a while.
It would be a selfish thing for you to do.
Right.
And at the expense of our team or success or something that wasn't necessary to create questions, to create a controversy. I would take that as, you know, personally, because it's not in the best interest. Nor were you right in doing that, because maybe you didn't do your homework. I'm not saying that you did or you didn't. Or maybe you heard something from somebody else. You read it somewhere. I see it every day when I look at the paper and I hear what trades are happening. And I can remember a phone call from in my earlier days from Dr. Ramallin. He called me and he says, "Are we really doing that?" And I said to him, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Did you see the headlines of the paper?" So I said, "No, I haven't." When I looked at the paper, I couldn't believe what I read, because there couldn't have been anything farthest from that. Where it came from, I have no idea. That was my first impression in my first 2 weeks. So I said to myself after that, okay, you're in the real world right now.
Tell us a little bit about what your kids are up to and how they've grown up around hockey.
The oldest, Chris, of course, has been in the business. Was with me with New Jersey through two cups. And then when I left New Jersey, he left. And then Garth had hired him here, so he was here a year before I came here. So he's back with me. And, you know, he has, not because he's my son, he has one of the better minds that I've seen in the game. Maybe the last name gets in his way. And I have a daughter who lives in Carolina, married because her husband's job is there, and a little boy and a little girl. Chris has three girls, and my youngest one is the deputy counsel for Legends in New York and has been there for a while, and he has a little girl. So I have six grandchildren, five girls and a boy, and I'll spoil them as much as I can, as often as I can, as they allow me to do.
Did they get, though, from you the work ethic and the discipline that you wanted them to grow up with?
You'd have to ask them that. I'm proud of them as can be. Each and every one of them, you know, have been successful in what they've done. Both Chris and Heidi went to Providence College. Timmy went to Boston College because he used to visit my daughter when she went to BU graduate school. She went to BU graduate school, and he liked Boston. So I tell everybody the reason he went to Boston, he couldn't get in Providence.
Do you see yourself in them, one more than the others?
I couldn't answer. I think the thing that I like the most about the three of them, they're individually capable of doing, you know, what they like to do, and I'm proud of them, and I think that's the best way you could put it.
It sounds like you considered during, you know, at the end of the Toronto time, and you said taking a little time off or taking it easy. Do you ever see yourself, you may never take it easy or take time off. You spend some time with them in the summer. How do you balance that?
Well, now we're getting into my personal life. and I think that I've said enough about the kids and the grandkids and all of that.
Okay, let's go back to the Hockey East. Couple more things. Spearheading the formation of Hockey East, where did that idea come from?
Well, when I left coaching at Providence to just be athletic director, because the agreement I had with the president was that when he asked me to do it, that I had to coach one more year because of the clash that I had recruited coming to Providence, and they thought I was going to be coaching. It wasn't fair. And then being athletic director, I'm sitting in all the meetings with the Eastern ECAC. That was the conference at that time. There was some 18 teams. The Ivies were in there and so forth. And there was a push from the Ivy Leagues to reduce the schedule in hockey, reduced the practice time, in my opinion, for the wrong reasons, you know, saying that it was too long. And I can remember saying, you know, they practice rowing for 12 months, they practice golf for 12 months, and now we're going to try and restrict hockey. I didn't like that. So I went to Father Monin at Boston College, Andy Meridian, the president of New Hampshire, and also John Simpson at Boston University, and said, you know, where are the schools that have had the most success in recent years in hockey? This is going to be a detriment to what we're doing. Here are my thoughts. The Big East basketball is a template. We're going to be criticized, and we only might have a handful of teams that will do this. Are we willing to do this? And then we were looking for a television contract, would never happen in hockey. So we went to Sports Channel at that time, and NESN was just in the formation. In fact, they had not any type of a showing. But I had felt that with the Bruins being involved and the Celtics being involved and the Red Sox being involved, they were eventually going to get on the air. So we signed up with them to give them content. And lo and behold, if you go back to history, their first telecast was a baseball. They never had a subscriber. They never had an audience. But look at NESN today, and Hockey East is on NESN today. They did the championship, so we were able to get the first television package for hockey, and the job that the Hockey East people have done today is just tremendous, and what it's done for the program. And you look at some of the players who have come out of there, whether the Leeches and the Richters and the Tkachuks and the Garants. I go on and on. So it became something very special, and we took a lot of pride in and feel very good about, but it was a little renaissance at the time, and for the right reasons, in my opinion. But I'm very fond of that and what it's come about.
Talk about vision. That reminds me, I wanted to ask you one thing about being ahead of your time, for sure with the Soviet players. And the question really is, why were you think, ahead of the curve in wanting to bring the players from Russia over?
Well, I think what happened there was maybe I was naive to the world and to the NHL, and I was just a hockey person. When I went to the Devils, you look at the reserve list, and they had, that is, Dr. McMullen had the vision to draft a Soviet player. So I looked at that, and I said, why not? And I remember the headlines that, you know, the Russians will never play, and they'll never play on my team and so forth, not from the Devils, and how difficult it was. And it just goes to show you how far the world has come, which is great, and that players play in the National Hockey League, you don't really know where they're from because the names are so similar, and you don't think about what the country is. You don't look at it that way. It's a worldly game. I think it's helped everything in the world that we could ask for. But I might have been in the forefront, but there were a lot of very intelligent, very supportive people who spent a lot of time to allow this to happen.
Is there anything, last thing, that you haven't done that you still want to do?
Yeah, winning the next game. That's the most important thing, the next challenge.
Simple request.
That's all.
Thank you so much for doing this.
I wouldn't do this if it wasn't you, Debbie, because this is not part of it, and I heard that you had asked to do it, and I appreciate the time we spent in New Jersey and, you know, the headaches I gave you.
Or the headaches I gave you. Thank you so much. That's Lou Lamoriello, president of hockey operations with the New York Islanders, and you talk about the places he's been and the people that he's met. What an incredible story. So great to chat with him. Could have gone all day. Here's our friendly reminder. You can subscribe to the NHL Executive Suite on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your shows. So until next time, I'm Deb Placey in the NHL Executive Suite.